Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this Courthouse Steps oral argument on the case argued yesterday before the Supreme Court, Trump v. CASA Incorporated. We're very pleased to welcome back our speaker, Michael Williams, who is the Solicitor General of West Virginia, along with Albert Lin, who is a former Solicitor General of West Virginia. And Albert will be moderating today. He is currently the Chair of Issues and Appeals at Hunt and Andrews Kurth. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speaker, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Near the end of the program, we will be accepting audience questions. So if you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Michael and Albert, thanks so much for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thanks, Edie. And thank you again to the Federalist Society for hosting. For those of you who didn't join us on Wednesday for the preview, I'll just sort of say again, I'm here with my friend and successor, once removed, Michael Williams, who, as Edie said, is the current Solicitor General of West Virginia. He's sitting in his beautiful office overlooking the Kanawha River, and he filed a brief on behalf of the state of West Virginia in this matter. Before joining the AG's office, Michael practiced in the private sector, and he is a former law clerk to Judge Agee of the Fourth Circuit, and then Chief Judge Chazanow of the District of Maryland. So thanks again for coming back, Michael. I didn't scare you away after Wednesday's session.
And I didn't embarrass myself too badly, but I will say that I still call this Albert's office. So sitting in the Albert Lin office.
So let's not bury the lead. After a couple hours of argument yesterday, we can get into the details, but how do you think this is going to come out?
I'm going to give you an unsatisfying answer, which is I have no idea. No, I think if you were forced to make me guess, I'd say we're still likely to see a decision that's favorable for the government. But I'm far less certain of that outcome than I was going in. I think, as I said to you going into this, I would have said this is going to be a 6-3 opinion that's going to largely be explaining why universal injunctions aren't justified in any circumstance, potentially even why Article 3 doesn't support them, and that's that. I think after the argument, I would say some of the justices who I would have assumed were almost sure votes for the government are certainly not sure votes for the government. Justice Gorsuch in particular, who is somebody who has written on these issues extensively before, was asking some very pointed questions and asking some tough questions of the government. So while I would still say, gun to my head, it's likely going to be a win for the government, it is not a certainty that I might have projected a couple days ago when we last talked.
So before we get into the details, because I think that might inform, sort of what was said and what questions were interesting to you, because that might inform what this thing looks like, because I think it'd be quite nuanced. One, let's start with one threshold question. There was some discussion of the merits yesterday of the birthright citizenship question. I noticed Solicitor General Sauer actually started both his opening and reply by hitting the merits, which I thought was interesting.
Right.
And Justice Alito even asked, should we reach the merits? Do you think this is they're going to reach or comment on the merits? Maybe just the question on the majority opinion, I suspect the dissent will, if there is one. Or do you think it's going to be mostly or entirely focused on universal injunctions?
So I still think it's unlikely they're going to get to the actual merits of the birthright citizenship order. I heard some prognosticators yesterday suggesting we're going to see an order today for supplemental briefing, and there's going to be a hurried additional argument before they're out for the summer. I'm really skeptical that that's the case. So I think
hopefully it doesn't come out during this hour.
Yeah, we'll see. That's, you know, it wouldn't be the first time or the 12th time that I've been wrong. So whatever, but, you know, I'm still skeptical. So I guess I think that maybe the merits were more relevant than I was suggesting a couple days ago in a couple key ways. I think there are justices who really see the merits question as a necessary part of the injunction analysis, but obviously because it's part of the four-prong test for injunctive relief, of course, but they really think I heard it phrases, you have to take a peek in order to really understand the appropriate scope of the remedy. And I think that's a fair point. And then I think maybe more practically speaking, the merits are going to kind of inform the practical concerns that some of these justices expressed. I mean, I think some of these justices were really working from a place where they said, this is just a facially, flagrantly unconstitutional order, and we want to make sure that we don't kind of make it too hard for folks to get appropriate relief. So they're almost working backwards from that assumption. And let me be clear, I don't necessarily buy that assumption, but that was at least the voice that we heard. So I think the merits are still maybe more relevant than I would have thought maybe coming in, but I don't think we're going to get, you know, a part three explaining why the CEO can't be applied.
So why don't we just sort of, maybe you want this, maybe you don't, so give as much as you'd like, but let me just ask you an open-ended question, right? I mean, what sort of stood out for you from yesterday's argument? What kind of things were surprising to you? And then maybe we can drill down into some of them.
Yeah, so I think maybe what wasn't a surprise from a strategic perspective is respondents really took a position of trying to recharacterize this as a case that didn't concern universal injunctions at all. And I think the state of New Jersey in particular did a quite effective job of really saying, no, we're not asking for what you might call a universal injunction. We're just asking for a necessarily broad injunction because of the realities of citizenship and how people can move across state borders all the time. And what does that then look like? And how would we apply an injunction that applies in New Jersey, not New York? I think the general did a great job in terms of his ability to kind of hone in on those practical considerations from the state's perspective and really make use of the breadth of state power. And I saw very little discussion in the argument about the government's argument that really states don't have that broad power and can't sort of act in that broad way. They didn't seem to really bite on that issue. I think it maybe only came up in rebuttal briefly from General Sauer. So I thought that was interesting. I think we heard from CASA that they did try to kind of take on the issue of universal injunctions a little bit more head on and really try to defend kind of a public interest notion of universal injunctions, that when an issue is particularly significant, that's when a universal injunction is necessary. I found that less compelling, candidly, and I think maybe she even felt less compelled by that point as well, because she did pivot away from that a couple times. But there really was kind of a bob and weave from respondents on this in a way that I think you and I talked about was kind of an obvious out for the court. If they find that this just isn't the case to speak on the issue, they could take that route and leave for another day the question of whether universal injunctions is properly understood or actually constitutional or the like. From the government, you know, I thought there were a few things that were interesting. I think General Sauer didn't really take some of the lifelines that I felt like some of the court was trying to offer him on occasion. He built the whole conception of alternative remedies really focused in on Rule 23, and frankly, as we did in our amicus brief. But then while also saying, you know, there's the Rule 23 route, then said, but I'm not going to concede that this would appropriately be certified, and actually went as far as laying out some of the specific reasons why it wouldn't be appropriate for class certification. And that, I think, really raised a lot of alarm from some quarters of the court, right, that this is all just a shell game where we're trying to close off the avenues of relief for plaintiffs. I think the big headline was the colloquy between General Sauer and Justice Barrett on the government's acquiescence document, doctrine or policy or whatever you want to call it. And his sort of careful use of the caveat that they generally acquiesce to a Second Circuit decision in the Second Circuit. I wish if I were in his shoes, I don't know what his client asked for. I would have wanted the client to allow me to go a little bit farther than I think he did. But I also think that maybe there's a little bit too much hand wringing in some of the post game coverage, because I do think he was really talking about the distinction between a binding judgment versus an opinion, and how the government, of course, acquiesces to an opinion while respecting the scope of the judgment. And I think some people were almost reading it to say we're going to thumb our noses at a binding judgment. I certainly don't think that was what he was saying. That those are a few of the things, I guess. I don't know if that's enough to start, but
no, I think it is. Maybe let's. So I'm really interested in talking about, and particularly given your current job, the state's argument and where that's going to go. But let's table that for 1 second, because it probably makes sense to just start with General Sauer's argument and some of the stuff that came up there. I mean, one thing that you've mentioned is Rule 23 as an option. And, I think at one point, was it Justice Gorsuch maybe asked him, and said, you come here and you've told everybody that Rule 23 is a cure-all. Explain to me kind of how that would work. Do you think the court, did the majority seem receptive to Rule 23 as sort of the alternative option for individual? And I think we're really just talking about individuals here. I think associations and states and all that, that's a different discussion.
Right.
But for Rule 23, there was a lot of discussion about, is that really going to work? Can you certify on an emergency basis? I mean, what do you think the court's receptivity to that was?
That was one area where they were a little more hostile than I anticipated. I mean, I thought Rule 23 was sort of an obvious avenue, and there certainly was a willingness to play ball on the issue, but I think people were not just taking General Sauer's suggestion at face value that there's such a thing as, I think he was terming it, emergency certification or immediate certification, where you can jump right out of the gate and get a big class certified. One of the interesting questions, I think, was actually from Justice Alito, when he sort of just said, what difference does it make? I mean, if you're going to end up with a huge class anyway, then why does it matter if it's really characterized as a universal injunction or a Rule 23 certified class? I think that was actually an attempt to help General Sauer, because it's an opportunity for him to explain that there are, of course, rigorous standards that have to be met for purposes of class certification that don't for purposes of a universal injunction. But again, that was another moment where there was a little bit more hostility behind that question than I would have expected from that corner of the court. I guess the short answer to your question is, I think that Rule 23 is still going to be a part and a centerpiece of any opinion for the government, but it certainly was not just the panacea that I think maybe the government was hoping it might be.
It was interesting. I think Justice Kavanaugh said at one point that if we rule you the way that the federal government wants here, we're going to see class actions filed tomorrow. In fact, they're probably being prepared right now. Let me ask another question on this. There was at one point, Justice Sotomayor, I think, and maybe Justice Kagan both honed in on the idea that the two different arguments, and you and I talked about this the other day, that the government is making, the equitable restrictions sort of stemming from the Judiciary Act and all that, and right, then separately, the constitutional restrictions stemming from Article 3. And I think at one point, Justice Sotomayor said, if you're making an Article 3 argument about the ability of courts to grant relief to non-parties, would that affect, I don't know if she said the APA, but perhaps the APA, but I think she did specifically ask, what about class actions? Is that, giving relief to non-parties in a way that would be impermissible under Article 3? What did you make of that, kind of honing in on the distinction between the more statutory, if you will, argument about equitable power versus the constitutional limitations?
Yeah, I thought it was a savvy point, because I think in some of the bigger cases and before this court in recent years, that the out has always kind of been that Congress can intervene to fix things. I mean, our beloved major questions doctrine here in West Virginia is really about congressional power and the exercise of congressional authority. It's not about judicial authority in that sense. So she was really kind of putting the feet to the fire and saying, well, you know, you guys always talk about giving Congress the keys, but you're stripping even them of the ability to provide relief in this broader way. And I think that is a fair point. I ultimately don't agree in the sense that I don't know that I agree with the way that she was conceiving class actions. I mean, the point of class actions, of course, is that the representative party is there. And once class certification occurs, members of the class are no longer non-parties. I mean, even to the point where the people who represent that class have ethical obligations that run to the members of the class in the same way that they do to their own, you know, their own named identified clients. So I think maybe that's the disconnect between how I would view it and how she would view it. But I think it is a fair point to say that the Article III issue goes a little bit farther than the historical issue that we talked about as being related and bound up in some sense, but necessarily distinct. And so maybe a way to do it, if you're, I'll call it the conservative majority, but just an anti-nationwide injunction majority, is really just to focus on that historical approach and say, we're just interpreting the Judiciary Act, and it's not there in the equitable powers, so we're done. And then they kind of avoid that problem. That's at least how I would think about doing it.
What did you make of another question from sort of the left side of the bench of Justice Kagan, you know, honing in on the incentive of the government to actually bring cases to the Supreme Court if they lose? What do you think that got any traction, and what was she driving at there?
I think that was maybe, to go back to your first question, that was maybe the most surprising part of the day, was that there was really a deep concern, I felt, from almost all members of the court, that they wanted this issue to be resolved in some way. And they weren't, frankly, I heard a lot of skepticism that it was going to be a good day for the government on that day. And that they were really, as I think I said at the beginning, kind of working backwards from that. How do we give them that answer? And what's the best way to give them that answer? It's a little bit unfortunate, because I think it may signal too that there's a little bit of skepticism about the government abiding by some of the sort of accepted norms in some of these cases anymore. And again, I think the colloquy between Justice Barrett and General Sauer is kind of a reflection of that they're worried that if they take too narrow an approach, that it's going to invite the sort of gamesmanship that just was sort of presumptively off the table for the government in years past. The biggest surprise of the day for me was that they were working backwards from the idea that they needed to provide a remedy on the meat of the issue at some point, and that they weren't necessarily going to have an entirely good faith government working with them to get them there. Very, very surprising.
Yeah. I thought that was very interesting, because, you know, Solicitor General Sauer started with his 2 minutes, right? The 2 minutes that he gets uninterrupted, for those who aren't super familiar with Supreme Court argument, I didn't time it, but it was probably, you know, 30 seconds on sort of merit and history doesn't support universal injunctions. And then he had like a minute and a half where he just rolled through the practical problems with universal injunctions. And I mentioned that because, to the point that you're making, what was really interesting to me was that two things about that. One, as Justice Alito said, like, you know, and there was a lot of discussion about how you're going to squeeze the balloon and the balloon's going to just take a different shape. Like, those practical problems aren't going to go away.
Right.
And second of all, they didn't actually seem to be at some times really that concerned with the practical problems. I mean, I think, you know, General Sauer said a number of times, this really stresses the court's emergency docket. You know, requires these issues to come up here on a thin record without enough percolation. You know, I think at one point the chief said, "We did the TikTok case in a month." Seemed a little bit flip, because I don't think you could do every case in a month. But it was interesting to me that they actually seemed a little bit less concerned about the practical downsides and more concerned about, can we actually be deciding this?
Yeah, and that the ability to render a decision quickly actually seemed to cut both ways, right? Because part of the concern, of course, was that if they don't have nationwide injunctions, then these cases are going to linger for 2 or 3 years, and you have babies that are sort of in citizenship purgatory. And I think when Chief Justice Roberts was talking about TikTok, he was saying it in the context of, we can have an ordinary case with an ordinary sort of scope, and we can still have those cases run a pretty quick track, right? And so I think. That could really go either way, but you're right. I thought percolation and the like were going to be more appealing to them than it ultimately proved to be. I think they're far more comfortable with their own emergency docket than maybe the public at large is, judging from the argument at least. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought there was. I don't know if people still use this term. Or maybe I'm showing my age, but I thought Justice Alito subtweeted somebody at one point where he said, "There are some of us up here have expressed concern about." The way these cases are being decided.
Yeah.
I caught that. Well, we have a question that is related to, let's talk a little bit about, I mean, how do you think history is going to play out here? Justice Thomas asked basically the same question of everybody, which is, tell me about the history. Someone has asked about the Bill of Peace, who, you know, probably didn't rightfully didn't go through all of the briefs and learn about the Bill of Peace, but let's try to retread a little bit of that historical ground. There was a lot of discussion about that. The Solicitor General of New Jersey talked a lot about history. How's that going to play here, you think?
As I said, I think the historical route is a way to kind of avoid some of the complications with taking the broader Article 3 route. So maybe we see a Justice Thomas opinion that takes the historical route, who knows? But there wasn't as much tension on the actual history as I thought there might have been. It seemed to me like there was general agreement. I think the government maybe conceded more than I was expecting them to, that there were some sort of early-ish iterations of things that might look like universal injunctions, you know, in the era of like the 1930s and just maybe a few years before. Our own West Virginia v. Barnett became a point of discussion at one point. So I think it was interesting that the parties all seemed to agree what we talked about before, that this was not, other than the Bill of Peace, this was not something that was seen a lot in the English courts of chancery, and then it was not seen in sort of early American post-colonial courts, and then we see it kind of pop up sporadically a little bit in the sort of early 1900s into 20s and 30s, maybe depending on how you characterize some of those decisions. And then there's this kind of silent period, and then it springs to life to some degree in the 1960s, but it's really 2007, 2008, 2009 is when we all of a sudden see a lot of this stuff really explode. I think there were a couple of comments, and honestly, I don't remember which justice it was. It sounds like an Alito comment in my head, but the idea that, you know, courts were able to survive even.
I think it was Justice Thomas. We survived until the 1960s without universal injunctions.
Right? Exactly. There's still a little bit of a, you know, snippetiness, I guess, on the point, but the facts I seem to be, I think they were generally accepted for what they were. And then whether that ultimately holds sway, is a different question. I think other than Justice Thomas, I didn't see a lot of people putting a ton of stock in that, even though some of the court's cases do. And as I said, it seems to provide an easy route in solving some of these problems. So that's maybe a roundabout way of saying that it was much ado about nothing. I don't even know. Yeah.
I mean, I think I heard a couple sort of interesting points. It did seem as though the justices on sort of the right said a couple times, let's assume, or what if we think, or it does seem like the Bill of Peace is more of a predecessor to Rule 23 than anything else. And just in terms of what the historical analog was, there was some, I think, debate about whether a Bill of Peace is binding on all the parties that got that get the Bill of Peace. I think the New Jersey Solicitor General actually disagreed with General Sauer's assertion on that point. Do you think that kind of nitty gritty is really gonna matter?
It could. If they take the Judiciary Act route that I'm talking about, it absolutely matters. And that's, you know, Professor Sahani's point is that getting these characterizations right is very important. And I think Professor Bray is the other one who sort of takes the other view, that bills of peace were a relatively relatively different animal, both in that they were discrete classes and the nature of this binding versus non-binding question. Mm-hmm. I do think at one point the discussion to build peace got a little bit off because it really became about like, can we identify the class? It's almost like an ascertainability question. And that, I don't think that's the relevant question. The question really is more about binding versus non-party and the party and who's bound and in what sense, because it's that binding stuff that really gets down to these practical considerations that the government's complaining about, right? The serial litigation and getting to take multiple shots at an EO and different favorable venues. You don't get that if you don't get binding classes, right? So we'll see.
One last question on history. I think I heard Kelsey Corcoran, who is representing CASA, say, well, yes, you do look at sort of founding era history and, English courts of chancery, but Justice Barrett, I think she pointed to the Rahimi decision. You sometimes look at American tradition. Mm-hmm. And I think she was trying to kind of bring in the West Virginia Board of Education case and here's others.
Yeah, I had seen that in some of the academic literature, so I guess I was expecting to see that. But I don't think that's a great strategy for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is you have this sort of quiet period, right? Maybe a 100 years almost, depending on how you put it, of just nothing. So I don't think that's great for them. But I also think it's a little bit disingenuous to point to decisions like West Virginia. And I think General Sauer made this point in rebuttal, because there was no discussion of remedy at all. It was solely focused on the merits. So I think maybe I'm being unfair, but especially at that time, remedies as a distinct question often just wasn't even on the table. They didn't teach remedies as a separate course in law school back then. I don't think I would necessarily draw a bunch of silent inferences from those cases. And I think she was maybe asking the court to do a little too much in doing that.
One thing that, and before maybe we turn to New Jersey, but one thing that you and I talked about on Wednesday was, could we see sort of a pre-Loper type Chevron admonition? Like, we've told you to apply all the tools of statutory interpretation before you get to Chevron step two. We're really telling you, like you said, sort of the hour style opinion. Mm-hmm. And would they do that here? Universal injunctions are disfavored. No, we mean they're really, really disfavored. And I think somebody said, it was either Alito or Gorsuch, was like, we've kind of already done that and it doesn't really work. I don't know if you picked up on that.
I'm going to be honest, I did not hear that because that would have been... maybe that was when I was picking up my order from the Starbucks counter or something, but I agree with whoever said it, I guess, is what I would say. And I do think I was actually having the instinct that if they were going to rule against the government, that that's exactly what they would do. It's just a silly exercise, honestly. I mean, everyone understands already the universal injunctions are disfavored. I think even the Ninth Circuit, which is arguably the circuit friendliest to these injunctions, has said that itself. So I just don't know what more that adds to the discussion.
Okay. Well, let's turn to the state of New Jersey, because I think you and I had discussed on Wednesday, mm-hmm. could the chief be looking for sort of a Marbury style opinion here where he gives some relief without, but pairs back universal injunctions at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, I was thinking about that a lot as I was listening to the New Jersey Solicitor General, who, as you noted, I thought did very well. Mm-hmm. Could the states get relief here in something that is not a universal injunction, but is very broad, while at the same time, maybe we see, some explanation that universal injunctions, such as they are not permissible. Where do you think the states are going to end up after listening to yesterday's argument?
So as I said, I didn't see the idea that states don't have, I guess I'll call it broader standing. I know that's kind of a loose way of putting it, but the government was really making a straight up argument in their initial applications that states shouldn't enjoy some of these special privileges and recognition of broader interests. And that wasn't going anywhere. So start from that idea, that we do have broader interests. I think New Jersey, as I said, did exactly the right thing from their perspective and said those broader interests necessarily lead to broader relief that doesn't necessarily constitute a universal injunction. And I think if we're going to see a loss to the government, I would put $100 on it's going to be written in the way that he described it, that it's not going to be a full-throated endorsement of universal injunctions. No, absolutely not. It's going to be a statement that this is not, in fact, a universal injunction, but just sort of a unique case in which you have a plaintiff coming to a court with exceptionally broad interests that are relevant to an exceptionally broad class of persons who are affected. And so it would almost tie what General Sauer was talking about with an indivisible remedy. It would almost tie that idea in with the breadth of the state's interests and put the two together and you get something big. And I began to think, boy, is that where the chief is going with his question about redistricting? I mean, is that kind of, he's pairing that indivisibility up with a powerful plaintiff and now you get there. Again, I don't agree. I think it is possible to parse out relief among the states. And honestly, I expect it was an unsatisfying answer to the court, but I think General Sauer had it exactly right when he said any of these problems about cross-border difficulties and the like are largely problems for the government as the defendant, not the states. So, take that for what it is. But if we're going to see an anti-Trump or I guess I'll call it pro-ish opinion for universal injunctions, I think it is going to be the New Jersey route. They're going to lean heavily on the states.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting to me. I listened to you and I both know, for those of us who follow the Supreme Court, have done Supreme Court arguments, the reply is, I think, sometimes less of a thing than in other appellate courts. You sort of get a chance to kind of say a few things. But I will note that I listened carefully to General Sauer's reply or his rebuttal. And I didn't feel like he really took the states on that strongly. I think he said something like, well, the states don't have standing, and that's kind of where we rest our argument. Mm-hmm. And so if they do have standing, then you open the door to a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah, I expect he's probably in a little bit of a difficult position, to be honest with you, because he doesn't want New Jersey and Massachusetts and Washington and California running around the country and suing them ad nauseum like they're already doing. But the administration also recognizes that they have some friendly faces among the states, and they probably enjoy the ability to have those allies in certain circumstances. So I don't envy his position here. I obviously have a conception of state standing that's colored by my present position, your former position. And honestly, I do think that states have relatively broad standing, and you don't even have to lean on parents patriae to get there. I note that the New Jersey SG was not was pointedly saying these are specific pocketbook injuries that require broad relief, not just parents patriae magic voodoo words. I think he showed a very careful touch in being very pointed about the specific state interests that sometimes require broad relief. And I think that's probably why you didn't hear a more pointed answer from the general, is I think even conservatives agree that that's the case.
Yeah. And not to beat a dead horse on the state, but, I think the New Jersey Solicitor General at one point articulated three buckets.
Right.
And those buckets then sort of drew, happens, right, in these arguments, somebody says something that kind of works, yep, and people just take it and run with it. Right. And I think Gorsuch even at one point said, your three buckets are very thoughtful. Mm-hmm. And just to recap for the people who are listening who may not, I think the first bucket was sort of where you can't get complete relief. I think that's what he was arguing for here for the states. The second was congressional authorization. And then the third was the when universal injunctions are so super, super important, then
right.
Okay. And he was kind of taking a task on the third one, and he sort of ran away from it, I think, as quickly as he could. But it is interesting to me. I mean, could we see, to your point, sort of an embracing of those three buckets and then a rejection, essentially okay, one, okay, two, three is, no, there is no super, super important exception for universal injunctions. I mean,
Yeah, I think he's described the way that the conference discussion is going to go now, because I think it's likely, if I were guessing, and I would say it's a win for the government, I would say bucket one is, yes, that's fine. Bucket two is, we'll leave that for another day, maybe. And bucket three is, absolutely not. And then if it's a win for CASA or the states, I think it's, yes is great, two is great, and three is probably not okay, right? That they maybe they write another little note that says, shame on you, don't embrace these. Because as I said, the CASA advocate, you know, Kelsey was much sort of more all in on that third bucket. And I didn't see that getting a lot of traction. I think she even realized that. I think maybe it was Gorsuch even said, oh, I see you're trying to jump out of bucket three now. But yeah, I thought that was interesting that they seemed to coalesce around the way he was conceiving of it. And I agree. It's a way to think about it. And I think the public interest, the third bucket, just has never, I don't think that was going to get five votes from this court.
Right.
It was a neat way of saying, take that and you can say bad things about that, but we're over here.
Yeah. No, it is an effective strategy. Like, here's the punching bag.
Right.
And I'm really far away from the punching bag.
Yeah.
But it does. And, you know, I think Justice Barrett picked up on this later when she was talking to Kelsey about, let's set aside the APA, which I think falls under bucket two, congressional authorization for broad relief. Let's set aside associations and states, because they may need their bucket one and they may need, you know, a broader injunction to get complete relief. Mm-hmm. And so again, it did seem like Justice Barrett was sort of, and then it's like, well, bucket three for individuals, that's taken care of by Rule 23, right? Do you think that there is anything that's going to come out of this on the APA or associations? I think Justice Kavanaugh at one point was like, no, I got it. The APA is different.
Yeah. No. I think associations, I don't think they're touching that. I think I said that before, and I saw nothing to suggest differently. That's a whole other big fight.
Kelsey did reach for the Chamber of Commerce and the NRA, though, right?
I know. So, good job helping out CASA, Elber. But I don't think they get there. And then the APA, yeah, there seemed to be a pretty quick recognition that it's a different animal. And I think that General Sauer, I think also was kind of almost talking about the way I was on Wednesday, where it's more equivalent to a court of review. So maybe we're more comfortable with that idea. But I don't think they're getting there. No.
Okay. we have a ton of questions. But let me ask about maybe two other things.
Yeah.
The first is, Justice Jackson seemed to be in sort of a totally different area in terms of how she was viewing this case. In fact, I think she said multiple times, like, I don't really understand sort of the argument that's being made here and the concern about the limits on the court's power. And as I understood it, what she was saying was, why does it matter who the defendant is enjoined from enforcing the EO against whom the government is enjoined from enforcing the EO? Isn't it okay simply for a court to tell the government to stop doing the unlawful thing, period? I think she almost said something like that, right? Stop doing this, full stop. We don't have to assess against whom. So long as the court has, you know, can exercise personal jurisdiction over the defendant, it can tell you, stop doing this unlawful thing. That she hit that, I think, a couple times. And I guess my question is, to the extent you have a view on it, what do you think of it? And do you think it was getting any traction with anybody?
What do I think of it? I strongly disagree. I can't say enough how much I disagree. I think it's inconsistent with the conception of standing that court has embraced for 100 years or more. And the idea is just it's you're not there to assert the rights of absent people, at least outside the class action context. That's kind of the whole point of the discussion, right? And this gets into a little bit, you know, the standing of absent class members in that question. It kind of alludes to some of those same concepts that she seemed to be wrestling with in this case. But I don't see how you can reconcile many, 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 many cases that the court has issued saying standing really matters with her sort of broad quasi declaratory judgment approach. It doesn't work for me. Do I see it getting any traction? No. I didn't see anybody else sort of picking up the thread. And I think she recognized as much. Maybe she's just sort of starting the discussion. And maybe it is sort of more for the absent class members context. Maybe we talk more about that in that context. But I certainly didn't see anybody else biting. And I'm happy because I don't know that it works, honestly.
So last question I have for you, and then maybe we'll just go to some of the questions that there are. But let's close with the merits. So you've expressed that you don't think they're going to reach the merits. And I think I read it the same way. I did like the moment where Kelsey said, "I'm here asking you for cert before judgment right now." Do you take anything about the ultimate outcome on the merits from this? I mean, there were some very strongly stated views from a handful of justices, mm-hmm. but did you actually count five on the merits?
I didn't count five. I'm gonna cheat a little bit and say I just got a holistic feeling that the government was not gonna win on the merits. Period. And I there's no principle basis for that other than some of the ways in which some of the questions were posed, particularly by Justice Alito, for instance, like seemed to be sprinting away from the merits anytime the case went that direction.
Interesting.
And so I take that as sort of a signal that he knows the votes aren't there and he's trying to cat it off. I don't know, Justice Kagan, at least in the past, when I've listened to her questions, she doesn't seem to be doing this sort of like rope-a-dope thing where she's misleading people about what's going on. She seems to be asking very frank, candid, and direct questions. And she really did seem to be just saying to the government, like, you're not going to win here. And I didn't get the sense that like that was her personal view. So just things like that. I don't know that I could give you the five votes today or tell you what the vote count's going to be, but just it just felt a little bit like it was a foregone conclusion on the merits. I don't know.
So I have sort of it's not even half baked. It's like a quarter baked thought that just popped into my head because I was thinking when you said Justice Alito was sort of sprinting away from the merits. I was remembering the gay marriage cases and how the court, one strategy that the court has taken in difficult cases is to deny cert until they absolutely have to take the case, right? And you could see in this case, if the government never won, and you didn't have the concern about sort of the case-by-case problem that I think Justice Kagan was talking about, you could see the strategy of the court being, we're just never going to take this because we don't have to, because everybody agrees that the government loses. So it is interesting. I think one of the sort of the tensions here, maybe which they never said out loud, is here's my quarterback thought, is they're losing the broad remedy also takes away one of their sort of favorite tools in deciding cases by not deciding them.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. And I think maybe Justice Barrett's questions about the acquiescence thing actually was also kind of getting at the same idea that like, oh shoot, if the government's not going to acquiesce, but they're also not going to take it up, then like, this is going to be a real problem for us. So I don't know. I don't know what to do with this particular question. It's a tricky one. they're trying to get this question answered. And I think judging from some of the questions that they were asking, they're not even sure how to tee it up yet is really where it's left.
Here's a question. I'm glad someone brought this up because I thought it was a particularly powerful moment for the opposition to the government. It's Justice Jackson's Catch Me If You Can hypothetical, that where she says you're creating a Catch Me If You Can regime. I think Justice Kagan picked up on it again. Did you sense that that was an effective question and that that might somehow influence the majority here?
Candidly, I didn't.
Interesting.
And honestly, I thought that General Sauer's answer was the one that I would have given on that question, which is it's more of a catch me if you can situation for the government, because you're just going to keep getting hit until finally some district court gives the plaintiff what they want, right? So I get the concern, and this goes to what we were talking about at the beginning, especially if you sort of dispense with the presumption of good faith on the part of the government. I get where a question is coming from. But I don't know that I would agree that it's really, I mean, ultimately, like Rule 23 is a real thing. And I know that there were questions about its effectiveness and all that. But that would, for instance, a broad certified class would solve a lot of the catch me if you can problems that she was worried about. You could theoretically bring just a class of, just define the class by reference to the EO. I'm not sure why you couldn't at least try that. That solves the problem right there.
So you're coming back to Rule 23 is helpful because Eric Wesson, who's a friend of both of ours,
friend of the pod, yeah,
yes, friend of the pod, longtime listener, friend of the pod. Yeah. Now the Iowa Solicitor General, had asked about the LabCorp case, which is the one about whether all members of a certified class have to have standing, essentially.
Right.
And I mean, you can answer his specific question, which I mean, if you'd like, but I think it kind of leads to a broader question, which is, if this goes the way that maybe you're suggesting it might, it certainly puts the spotlight back on Rule 23 and class actions again. The big Walmart versus Dukes opinion from, I don't know what that was now, a decade ago, I think was really important in terms of, paring back a bit on class certification. But, as we talked about, when you squeeze the balloon and you take away universal injunctions, it's going to put pressure on a different part of it. So what does this mean for sort of class actions generally? There's a whole class of plaintiffs and lawyers who bring class actions for a whole bunch of other things, not about illegal government action. It's like suddenly they're, people are invading their playground.
Well, and I guess Eric was prescient because we were sort of alluding to this earlier when we were talking about the conceptions of standing can definitely spill over into contexts like class and whether you need to look to the standing of absent class members. So in answer to a specific question, is this argument going to affect that case? I think the answer is yes. If we were in a wild world where something like Justice Jackson's conception of standing actually gain traction, and that would change all of those cases. I think it's more likely that a case like this one, especially if it does side with the government, will re-entrench sort of a rigid notion of standing that in turn is going to make class certification, at least at the giant scale, a little bit harder. But I don't think that this, I see Walmart as kind of easily distinguishable, but just because part of the issue with a B2 class in Walmart is it was one defendant, but it was really just a huge number of decision makers, right? So you were really attacking a number of distinct independent decisions that manifested in all kinds of different ways and caused all kinds of different injuries. A B2 class action was designed for civil rights violations like this one, where it's one actor, one policy, and its effects are felt broadly. So I don't know that certifying a class in this kind of case is really going to change the class action landscape that much. I think it really, if anything, returns to the original understanding of what B2s were meant to be, which is a singular kind of font of harm, and then just providing a cutoff for that singular font of harm.
Another question, not to unfairly go to friends of the pod, but Eric has a quote here from Justice Kagan from 2022, which just prompts me to ask, you know, we did emphasize on Wednesday that this is let's call it a bipartisan issue, maybe not necessarily non-ideological. And I still agree with that. But from the questioning yesterday, for those who subscribe to the idea that there are right-leaning justices and left-leaning justices, certainly felt like it was a little bit more partisan. I mean, why is that? It is. And at the same time, you had the New Jersey Solicitor General representing, I haven't looked at all the states, but I assume if you kept emphasizing 22 states, I assume they're all 22 blue states mostly. But at the same time, he was saying, you know, we recognize that universal injunctions should be used sparingly, if at all. Is there some tension there? I mean, am I missing something?
I don't think you are. Honestly, I was having some trouble. I was a little surprised myself. I thought that people would have a little more perspective on this than they seem to. And I think I was particularly, I don't know, disappointed is too harsh a word, because who am I? I'm just a guy. But I just...
You're the Solicitor General of one of 50 sovereign states. So.
The most important sovereign state, Albert, right now. I think Justice Sotomayor really did seem to buy in, for instance, into this, like, this is just a really important issue, and it almost, like, we just have to get there, and it almost doesn't matter how we get there, we just got to get there. And when I see stuff like that, I just take... that's a loss of perspective that I hope once we're out of the heat of the argument, they're back in chambers, they pull back from a little bit. Cause I think this absolutely is a bipartisan issue. I think it should be, I mean, there was an interesting map, I think, in the New York Times today, sort of mapping out where all these injunctions and various administrations had landed. And I don't see why we want the loaded gun on the table for any administration. It doesn't seem to me like anybody should be cheering for that.
Well, the loaded gun analogy is interesting, because Justice Sotomayor, I think, and as we are wont to do when we are arguing about issues, we try to come up with hypotheticals for the other side of the aisle, right? She kept using the analogy about what if they're going to take everyone's guns away? Could we not issue a universal injunction that stops that? Or does everybody have to go get a lawyer?
But that's okay. I guess I would, I'm going to pull back for a moment, take a breath. but that from the conservative perspective, that has happened, right? There have been really aggressive ATF rules that actually took away whole classes of what we would say are legal firearms. And what you do is you go file an APA action, or you pursue targeted preliminary relief, and you get your remedy, right? I mean, you either get a remedy that's targeted to the state, or you certify a class and you get a broad class-based remedy. And I don't think anybody was upset about that. We didn't need nationwide injunctions to solve some of those problems in the Biden administration. I mean, you saw pistol braces would be the one that comes to mind, I think, where it was an APA challenge. And you know, the rule purported to take away all pistol braces, and they prevailed. So the rule was knocked out, and that's exactly how it's supposed to work. So I don't buy that. I understand the point that was trying to be made, and I understand that there are circumstances that require expeditious action, but that doesn't mean that the scope of the remedy has to change. If anything, it just means that the court needs to move a little faster. Right.
Right. I think that's right. Although let's flag, right, that it's easy, because, and even the New Jersey solicitor yesterday kind of fell into it as well. APA actions are different. And so, you know, we have certainly tabled them for now, as to whether you could get some sort of nationwide preliminary injunction under the APA. So there's a handful of questions here that I've kind of grouped together that are asked about, you know, how can they not reach the merits? Don't they have to say something about the merits? The, you know, country's not going to understand. And let me add this. I do think I heard Kelsey argue yesterday. I think she came very close to, if not crossed over into saying, that you can't just decide the remedial issue that in reviewing a preliminary injunction under Winter or in Ken, you've got to go through all of the factors. Like, there seemed to be a flavor of kind of like, how can you just decide the scope of the remedy? You have to decide whether the preliminary injunction was appropriately issued or not. So all of those, I think, can be grouped together. I mean, maybe you can sort of just explain, like, how can they just dump the merits here?
So I'll take them in reverse order. I think they can dump the merits because the government didn't file an application saying upset the whole apple cart. You know, they still recognize that there is appropriately an injunction that can stand here, but they're just targeting the remedy. And this isn't a Trump administration strategy. The example I would give you is in the Title IX context. The Biden administration took up an application. I believe it was characterized as an application for a partial stay, but I'm probably getting the posture wrong, where they tried to get the Supreme Court to peel back an APA action. So a preliminary injunction issued against the whole Biden administration's Title IX rule. And they said, well, you don't need to knock the whole thing down. You can just peel back on some of it and leave the rest intact. And so that was similarly kind of a remedies focused question that may or may not have actually given any insight on the sort of actual likelihood of success and all the underlying injunction factors that led to the remedy. Right. And so I think There just needs to be an acknowledgement that the injunction test is distinct from the ultimate remedy, and those implicate two distinct concepts. As for how do they not reach the merits, or are people going to be upset, or are people going to understand this? I mean, I get it. I think the public sometimes doesn't understand when a hot button case comes up and it's really about a procedural question, right? I mean, look, we fell victim to this in West Virginia EPA. People, I think, thought it was some broad statement by the court that they don't like air pollution control. And that, of course, wasn't what was happening. That's the challenge in writing a good opinion, right? You have to be clear about why you're doing what you're doing. And I have faith that our justices can do that. But going farther just to try to placate sort of the public perception of things, I think would be a mess. I'm not even sure. Yeah. Could they do that, Albert? I mean, that's a question for you, I guess, given your in-house experience. Given the scope of the application, could they just say, forget it, we're going to take the whole thing right now?
Oh, I mean, could they just like treat it as sort of cert before judgment? And
well, I mean, it's one thing to say, like, you come up to the court on preliminary or in an emergency posture, right, and say, can you answer this question for purposes of preliminary relief? Like that's what they did in SB8, right? In Texas, or am I wrong? Anyway, I think it's one thing to take a question and say, you know what, we're just going to go ahead and turn this into a full blown petition for cert. But to actually like rewrite the whole question to answer every question in the case in an emergency posture to me seems like a different animal when no one was asking for anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that their own limitation, the party presentation limitations, right, would probably, if not counsel against that, bar them from doing it. One of my favorite cases, the Sinanik Smith case, right, written by Justice Ginsburg, it's very important party presentation in our adversarial system.
Right.
Gets to the question, is it prudential? Is it Article 3 or whatever the basis for that would be? But I do think it would be very odd for them to answer more than what was asked of them. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I will admit to in sort of piggybacking on your very first question answer about how the question of the injunction is different from the question that the appropriateness of the injunction is different from the question of the remedy that you give, the scope of the remedy for the injunction. I will admit to not, you know, Kelsey Corcoran is a very good lawyer. I admit to not really understanding the argument that you can't just resolve the remedial question. And maybe that's because I myself have once asked for, you don't have to overturn the injunction. You just have to limit the scope.
Right.
So, it's 12:59. Tons of other questions. Well, we're not going to be able to get to them all. Let me just lightly give you one open-ended question before we wrap up. Is there anything that you wanted to mention that we haven't gotten to?
No. I guess
parting thoughts.
I'll take the bait from friend of the pod, Eric Wesson, who says, is it weird that Texas basically lost on a universal injunction and maybe New Jersey doesn't? I'm going to give the court a little more credit than that. I don't think those kinds of things come into play. I think it really is that they are trying to get it right. And when it comes to an issue like citizenship, maybe there's a practical recognition that the issue of citizenship is just necessarily broader than maybe some of the specific questions that were in play in those earlier cases. So I guess I'll just dismiss this. I will give the court enough credit to say that I don't think it's just like we're playing base partisan games here. I heard a court yesterday that was really trying to meaningfully engage with the issues in a very serious minded way. And whatever your politics, get the right answer. So I'm at least heartened by that. Even if the position I was advocating for didn't have the day I thought it might have, I was at least happy to see the seriousness with which they were engaging with the issues. So, yeah.
Great. Well, thanks, Michael. Edie has popped on to tell us that we're out of time.
Yeah, right at time. On behalf of the Federalist Society, thanks so much, you guys, Michael and Albert, for speaking with us again today. And we're so grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and other upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you all once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.